This episode is brought to you by Rancho Gordo, growing the best and most interesting heirloom beans available. Learn more at ranchogordo.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we look at how delivery went from convenience to crucial.
In a pre-COVID universe, the commissions from these third-party delivery service providers were really high, and you were seeing oftentimes they were as high as 30%, right?
I mean, all food is about basically the history of money and the history of technological change. But takeout in particular.
I'll go ring a doorbell and watch somebody come outside and wipe down their door and their doorbell after I leave. It's kind of creepy, kind of weird, but that's the state of where we are now.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your lonely co-host this week, Ethan Frisch, but we have a really exciting guest to introduce you to, somebody whose career path shares a lot with my own, and I'm really excited to dig into some spice talk with her. Simone Cormier is a chef and the chief spice sourcer for Allegro Coffee and Whole Foods. Simone, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be with you here today.
So, Simone, just let's get started with a little introduction explanation. Who are you and what do you do?
Great. So, I am a Cajun girl from South Louisiana originally. And in some capacity or another, I've worked as a chef since 1998. So, hard to say it, but already 22 years under my belt. I currently live in the Seattle area, and I'm the National Spice Coordinator for Allegro Coffee, which is a subsidiary of Whole Foods. And in that role, my main objectives are the sourcing of spices and qualifying suppliers, and then also the product development side of things. So as a research chef, developing custom seasonings, breadings, et cetera, for our customer base.
And how did you get into that? You had sort of a rough entry into the world of food. Tell us about your first job in a kitchen.
Oh, it was a very roundabout way to get into the kitchen. But my first kitchen job was at a restaurant outside of Lafayette, Louisiana. I started on the grill, which is pretty unusual. You know, you normally start at washing dishes or prepping vegetables, but for some unknown reason, this guy put me right on the grill. So I spent 7 months there and loved it, absolutely loved it. I felt like I really had found what my true passion was, just in and about and all about food. And then there was a new restaurant opening up in another town outside of Lafayette that a friend recommended to me that I should go and interview, you know, for a line cook position. And so I did. I met with the gentleman who was going to open the restaurant. We had a interview. And at the end of the interview, he said, "Well, great, I'd like to offer you a job." And I was like, "Okay, wonderful." And he said, "I'd like you to be my executive chef." And I was like, I think you must have misunderstood my interview. I was like, I don't have that experience. And he said, "No, but you have passion and a great work ethic that I can see." And he said, "You know, I've opened restaurants before and we're going to do it together and you'll be fine. And you're the one I want." And I was like, wow. I mean, I think I was in shock for several weeks after that. So that was my entree into the world as a chef.
Wow. And had you come from a sort of a food focused family? What was your exposure food or cooking growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, when you hear Louisiana and Cajun, you know, you realize it's a very food-centric culture. Both of my grandmothers were amazing cooks, but I spent more time with my maternal grandmother, and she was just renowned for her cooking. I mean, they had a farm, so they raised, you know, all their own animals. She had a huge garden, preserving, canning, you know, everything. And every Sunday, you know, that's like family day in South Louisiana. All the family would come, neighbors would come, and they would eat at her house because she had the best food. So I had that growing up. And I remember, you know, I was probably, you know, 9 or 10 years old. It got to a point, and she was older. My mom was like the baby of the bunch. And, you know, we lived a couple hours away. And I remember, you know, the minute I would arrive at the door, you know, after hugs and kisses happened, she would ask me when I was going to make the potato salad to go with the gumbo. You know, Sha, when you going to make the potato salad? And I was thinking about that last night, and I'm like, why did a great, amazing cook, why did she always want this child to make the potato salad? And my mom said, because she knew you would do it the right way, the way she would make it. And I never really put those two things together, but it was definitely a food-centric atmosphere growing up. I think I decided to start cooking in earnest, and I really don't know what the impetus was at the time, but something clicked. And at 14, I started really getting interested in cooking and buying cookbooks and just devouring them like novels and cooking my way through them. And, you know, pretty much by 15, I had thrown my mom out of the kitchen, which she wasn't fighting too much. She was kind of okay with that. I had a checkbook, I had a car, I did all the grocery shopping, and I did all the meal planning and all the cooking from that point on in our household until, you know, I moved out. And I remember one year I had bought this book called The Best of International Cuisine, which is still, I still have it. It's one of my favorite cookbooks. And I basically cooked us around the world for a year, you know, 2 weeks in France, a week in Algeria, Bulgaria, Japan, you name it. I cooked our way through that cookbook. And, you know, I can remember times my parents would come home from work and sit down to dinner, and they'll be like, okay, where are we now? Like, what country are we in this week? So I'm very much self-taught in that way, that I just got cookbooks and I cooked my way through them. And that's how I learned.
That's amazing.
Most of it.
Before we get too far away, I want to hear about the potato salad. What was your grandmother's method? What made it so special?
Well, I think first you have to think about the way Cajun people eat gumbo. Gumbo is something that in the summer, a lot of families, not all of them, but pretty much all the families that we knew, you would make a mayonnaise-based potato salad with eggs and a little onion, celery, green onion, little mustard, you know, a basic potato salad, but you would put a scoop of it in your gumbo with your rice, of course. Now, in the winter, the potato salad transformed to baked sweet potato pieces in your gumbo. But there was always, it was rice, gumbo, and one of those two components always in the same bowl. And, you know, you ate a mouthful, you know, bite of gumbo, a little bit of potato salad. I really don't know where that comes from, but that's what we had to do. And by God, the minute I got there, she wanted me making it. She was so worried that we wouldn't have the potato salad ready.
Do you still make dishes that you learned from her?
Yeah, I do.
What were some of your, like, classics or, I mean, gumbo has so many, there's so many versions, and yeah. I think it's been, not being from Louisiana or the South myself, I mean, I only have a very literally distant understanding of it.
Yeah.
So how would you describe, what makes Cajun cooking so special?
I think a lot of it is based on the fact that we use that dark roux. You know, a gumbo is something that you have to have that dark roux, and I make my own. It takes a long time. You know, you got to watch it. You can't scorch it. You cook it flour and oil until it gets to the color of milk chocolate, pull the pan off, and by the time it cools, it's the color of semi-sweet chocolate. And that's a perfect roux. So a lot of our dishes are based on the roux, and she was a master of all of those dishes, gumbos. Something that, you know, keep in mind about gumbos and Cajun seasoning in general, Cajuns don't use tomato in their gumbo. That's a Creole, that's a New Orleans addition and something that they enjoy. But down home Cajuns, we never put tomato in our gumbo. And you usually didn't use filet as a thickener. It was mostly, I think her specialty was chicken and sausage gumbo. No filet, don't have to have okra, and definitely no tomatoes. And as far as seasonings go, I always, you know, when I started working with spices and looking at, you know, formulations of Cajun seasoning. And, you know, you see them in cookbooks, like, you know, everybody has like a Cajun seasoning and they all have things that had nothing to do with Louisiana. Fennel or oregano, thyme, rosemary. I'm like, where do they get that from? These things were not being used back in the day, you know, of old Cajun cooking. Cajun cooking was salt, black pepper. Granted, it's not grown in Louisiana, but was widely available. And cayenne pepper. And then, you know, lots of garlic. We love garlic. And then what we call the holy trinity of onion, bell pepper, and celery. Those other spices, that's, you know, eventually they became available. But that was not, you know, what people were used to cooking with. It was very simple. Very simple food, but great depth of flavor, lots of layers of flavor, and just the thickening power and the dark, rich flavor that a roux gives to either a gumbo or sauce piquante or any other kind of gravy like that just adds incredible depth to it. Oh. So she was a master with using roux. And also another thing in South Louisiana we eat is called rice and gravy. And it's usually a tough cut of meat, thin, like a round steak. And it's browned and seasoned with the trinity and garlic, if you like, and just cooked into submission. And just adding a little, as it fully browns, a little bit of water at a time covering it, a little bit of water at a time covering it. And basically you're coaxing a gravy out of the meat using the fond or the brown particles left in the bottom of the pan and incorporating the water that way. So that's a rice and gravy.
That sounds delicious. So what would you, I mean, now being the spice expert that you are, what would you say makes a good Cajun seasoning? If I can use this word, an authentic Cajun seasoning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like I said, it's pretty simple. You know, there's a lot of local favorites in Louisiana, but I mean, you definitely have to have salt, black pepper, cayenne. A lot of them have garlic and onion. I'll give you a little secret on mine. I call it traditional Cajun. I do the salt, black pepper, cayenne, garlic, onion. I do the green onion. I do the celery. That's it, the garlic. And a little paprika for color, just to pull more color out of it. But it's those very basic flavors that I put into there. And I didn't add any herbs or spices that weren't used in the cooking, so.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of spices, after you'd worked in kitchens, you sort of made this transition to being a spice expert. How did that happen?
Yeah. Crazy. I was working for Whole Foods at the time in the Rocky Mountain region. I was living in Denver. And I was currently the regional executive chef for the Rocky Mountain region. And Allegro Coffee is, you know, a wholly owned subsidiary of Whole Foods, and they're based in the Denver metropolitan area. And about 2010, Allegro and Whole Foods top leadership were talking, and they were like, you know, it would be great if we had our own spice company, and it should be organic. We really promote organic, and it would be one company that all the regions and all the departments would use instead of every region and every department, you know, using their preferred choice with quality ranging from so-so to pretty good, and then pricing ranging from super cheap to super expensive. They're like, let's just bring it into one place, one source for all the stores, simplify it. It'll fit our quality standards. We won't have to worry about, you know, no-nos such as irradiation or treatment, gas treatment with ETO or PPO. And Allegro said, that's great. You know, we've got sourcing capabilities around the world for coffee and tea already. We're used to working with farmers. We understand those relationships. You know, it should be an easy fit for us and an extension of our coffee and tea program. So that's how Allegro was holding the baton for the spice program. So a co-packer was picked because we didn't have the equipment, you know, at the time. And it was like, you know, to get into this, we don't know anything about spices. So let's work with some experts in the field. and experts in organics and seasoning blends. So a supplier was found, and I started working with them, you know, testing and evaluating the quality of the spices. And then they had started working on reverse engineering some of the seasoning blends that the stores use. And I started working with their R&D chef, and I felt, you know, that those seasoning blends, the formulation still needed some tweaking. They weren't quite there yet. And that's how I started getting into the reverse engineering of seasoning blends. But at the same time, I was talking to Allegro, and, you know, I asked them, I said, well, you know, can you send me the product list of what we're going to be buying so I can, you know, kind of start getting things set up on my end? And I got the list, and it was like less than one page. And I said, I think you're missing some pages. And they were like, no, that's it. And I said, wow, you're missing a lot of spices. And I said, there's only like 12 seasoning blends. I said, there's probably upwards over 100 seasoning blends that Whole Foods uses in, you know, in prepared foods and meat and seafood, bakery, produce departments, you know, on corn for the summer. I was like, you're missing a lot. So I kind of filled out a form for them. I filled in the blanks, and I think they were shocked, and they realized that they were going to have the vice president at the time of Allegro kind of run the spice program in his, you know, spare time outside of his role as vice president. And they quickly realized that this was a full-time position. So I was already getting into it and discovering that I love spices. Like, I was getting really passionate about it, you know, from an executive chef role, whether you're in a restaurant or in Whole Foods, your horizon is like super open, you know, if you know what I mean. Like, you're looking and dealing with so many different types of products and processes and job responsibilities, but you don't often have that time to like completely laser narrow your focus down to like one particular area. And I was finding that really fascinating. So they posted a position. I interviewed for it. I got the position. I was probably a shoo-in because I had already been working on the program for like a month. So it was probably an unfair advantage. But and then the first 9 weeks of my job, I spent with the co-packer and reverse engineered, I believe it was 112 seasoning blends. And that in and of itself is an incredibly fascinating world, which I still enjoy to this day.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about that, because these were the seasoning blends that you're using in the prepared food, right? This isn't the packaged spices that somebody might
know. No. And, you know, we really started the program with the intent that this was going to be for back of the house, not retail. So this was what, you know, prepared foods would use for, say, rotisserie chickens. Meat would use for sausages. The seafood department would use for like already seasoned, you know, oven ready products. So that was the main idea of what we would be supplying. Retail came in a few years later.
Got it. And so, what was that process of reverse engineering the blends like? How do you even get started?
Yeah, I know. I didn't know either. And the co-packer that we work with and their R&D chef, you know, I have to give her credit. Like, she taught me everything I know. She's amazing. She's now been in the spice business for 20 plus years. So hats off to her. But luckily, I'm a quick study. And so reverse engineering. So say I have somebody sends me a sample of a herb rotisserie chicken seasoning. And they say, we want you to copy it and we want you to make it organic. So the first thing you need is obviously the sample. Sometimes you have a ingredient listing, sometimes you don't. Sometimes the ingredient listing is a little sketchy and a little vague. There's some things that sometimes people leave out. And obviously you don't have a recipe, like no one's gonna give you their recipe, that's proprietary. So you have a sample. And first you start with a dry evaluation. What we would like to do is just take a white piece of paper and have your control sample and then have like taste, aroma, visual. And you would put it out dry on the paper, spread it out. You would, you know, make notes on the visual, you know, what obviously you see, what can you identify, what size is it? Is it powder? Is it tea cut? Is it cut sift? Is it, you know, what mesh on the pepper? Is it coarse, which would be like a 14 or a 16 mesh? Is it cracked, which would be like an 8? Yada, yada. You do a smell evaluation. You know, what are the top notes, what comes in at the end, and then a dry taste evaluation. Literally just stick your finger in there and then taste it. After that, what we do is we make what we call a tea. So you would get a clear vessel, whether, you know, plastic or a beaker or what it may be, and you put 1 gram of the product in there, and then you do 100 milliliters of hot water. And basically, you know this, sometimes when you smell a spice, you really don't get any aroma off of it when it's dry. But when you add that hot water, that really helps to open up the aromatics. And it also, in the visual side of thing, will it'll extract color. So maybe if you're looking at something, but you don't notice it has paprika or you don't notice it has turmeric, when you add the water, those will start to be pulled out and you can see like, oh, I didn't realize there was a little bit of turmeric in there. And having that clear vessel to hold it up to the light, and as the particulate falls to the bottom of the glass, it really helps you see individual things. Like if it's a big cloudy white liquid, then you know there's probably onion powder in there. It really helps to separate the particles so that you can see the different sizes. Whereas, you know, in some mixes, it can be hard to do that dry because there's a lot of powder or granule material as opposed to a cut size that's really similar to it. So it really helps you get a lot more information. You get more aroma. It opens up the taste as well. And then you do a tea tasting. At that point, you start trying to figure out the formula. So formulas are 100% recipes. It's all done by weight. You know, most recipes for home use or even kitchens, you know, it's done by volume lots of times, cups, tablespoons, gallons, etc. But when you're multiplying up or down, those get really wonky sometimes just because they're not, you know, by weight, or people measure things differently. So it's all done by weight. 100% formula would be like a 100-gram sample. So I start and I list out all the ingredients that I know, all the cut sizes that I know. And then over time, you get experience as to what you think those percentages might be. Salt content, if there's sugar, your really potent things are going to be like super small percentages. And it's just a skill that develops over time. You make a blend and then you cup it or do a tea tasting against the original. And you go back to the drawing board and you tweak it as many times as you need to get it super close. And then what I would do is test it on whatever the blend was created for originally, whether it be a rotisserie chicken or sausage or as a pickling spice, what have you. And then at that point, you know, fat also helps pull out spice components. So some are more soluble in water. Some spices are more soluble in oil. So if it would be for a boneless, skinless chicken breast, that's what I would test it on. Because if I tested it on a skin-on chicken thigh, that fat could potentially make a difference in what the formulation should be. So there's all these variables, but, you know, it's extremely fascinating and it's a lot of fun, especially when you get it, you know, within, you know, less than a dozen tries. After that, it gets a little bit frustrating, but it's fascinating. And even just working only with organics, there's limitations, obviously, on what is accepted, you know, for organic certification and what's not. So you have to find some ways where a conventional seasoning would have a certain type of flavor or an ingredient that's not acceptable for organic certification. And then you'd have to figure a way to manipulate products to simulate that flavor profile or that color profile or whatever you're looking for with other ingredients. So it can be a challenge at times, but it's super fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like an incredibly detailed, complex process. And I'm going to ask you, I'd like to hear about some of the more challenging blends you worked on and how you got them right. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Rancho Gordo. Over the past 19 years, Rancho Gordo has led the revival of heirloom beans, taking the lowly bean from a healthy but neglected member of the vegetable family to a near superstar status ingredient. From growing the best and most interesting beans available, to making sure all crops are fresh and a pleasure to cook with, Rancho Gordo's mission is to encourage cooks to experience and enjoy the unique flavors of heirloom beans. Rancho Gordo produces nearly 30 varieties of heirloom beans and lentils, as well as corn, grains, chilies, and other cooking ingredients. You can learn more at ranchogordo.com. That's RANCHOGORDO.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and our guest this week is Simone Cormier, the spice coordinator for Allegro Coffee and Whole Foods. So Simone, tell us which were some of the more challenging blends to get right, and how did you figure them out?
There was one in particular. It was a spicy seasoned pepper that, you know, seemed like it should be pretty, you know, straightforward, but ended up taking me, I think, 13 tries to get it right. And it's just because it had so many different cuts, I mean, granule sizes of the pepper, and that there was white pepper, and there was black pepper, and there was chili flakes, and there was bell pepper. And it was so much of that going on where any little minute change you made, you know, could really vary the outcome of the product. And we ended up using, you know, we got the visual right, the aroma was great, the flavor was so close, but it wasn't quite peppery enough. And so that's when we added in a tiny percentage of oleoresin of black pepper, which is basically the essential oil of black pepper. And that tiny bit just popped it right up to the right space. So that's another, you know, interesting thing about working with spices and seasonings is that you also have a whole library of essential oils and, as we call them, oleoresins that can be added, which is really cool because sometimes you don't want to see a certain thing in a blend, but you want the flavor to be there. And that's why you could use a little bit of essential oil or oleoresin, and you don't necessarily have to have the spice in the blend. So it opens up to a lot of possibilities. But normally what I find are the most difficult to reverse engineer are the simpler seasoning blends, the ones with maybe 3 to 6 ingredients. I find those the hardest. Now, the ones with like 15 to 20, I find I can get those a lot quicker. And I think it's just because of the role the percentages play. You know, when you have a lot of ingredients, you know, you can rig the percentages a lot easier because, you know, you don't have to, you can space them out more, you know, if you know what I mean. Like if I need to pop up a flavor of something, then when you're dealing with a formula, 100% formula, you have to take it off of something else. You know, one way you could do that is if you were using granulated garlic and you just couldn't, everything else was in place, but you just needed more garlic. You know, what you could do is, well, I don't want to mess with my percentages too much. What I can do is take the granulated garlic and use garlic powder, which is more intense because the finer the particulate, the more the flavor spreads through your mouth when you take a bite. The larger the particulate, you may chew and you may not get, you know, a big piece of black pepper for a while, but then after a while you chew on a cracked peppercorn and you get an explosion of black pepper. So there's, you know, it depends on the effect that you want as to what you could do. But there's just so many ways that you can tinker with it. When you have a couple of ingredients like that, it tends to be harder for some reason.
Yeah. And throughout this process, how were you, or how was Whole Foods deciding what blends to make? Was that something that, like, you got to decide there was a blend that you wanted to try using, or was it coming from customers or higher up in the corporate structure? How were those decisions being made?
Sure. That's a great question. Originally it was, we needed to be able to provide what the stores were using currently from other vendors. So that was that whole initial 9-week stretch of reverse engineering. After that, I started getting requests to custom create seasoning blends. And that's when I really started having fun. That's even more fun than reverse engineering. And then I would, you know, after that, I just started studying a lot of trends and keeping up with, you know, consumer trends and restaurant trends, and started working on developing a portfolio, you know, of potential seasoning blends that could be used. And I called in my children, because I don't have children, and my children need a loving home. So once I create a seasoning blend, then I'll send samples out, you know, to various regions or departments or global people, trying to find a home for my new favorite child, as I call it. I have a stable full of children.
Tell us about some of them. What are some of your favorites? I don't know if you're allowed to have favorite children, I guess, but.
I think you're not supposed to say that. But since they're not technically children, let's see. I mean, there's so many. It's, you know, a lot of times I just work to see what cuisines are coming up on the horizon and what's going to be popular, and then digging into some research on what some of those traditional seasoning blends are. Or another thing I like to do is, say you want to make a seasoning for a potato chip, for example, and you want it to taste like, you know, bolognese sauce. That would be something where I would create a seasoning that would impart the flavors of tasting bolognese, but it would be in a form to use on a potato chip. So those are the ones that are really fun. I don't know. It's just kind of, you know, whatever strikes my fancy at the time. I go through a lot of passionate mood swings, you know, with spices and what's piquing my interest. But I don't know if I can talk about these on the air since they still haven't been released from the orphanage. So I think I'll keep them in the orphanage for a while.
Was there a point throughout this whole process where you decided that you wanted to make spices the focus of your career, where you realized going back to cooking wasn't what you wanted to be doing, and this is where you wanted to be?
Well, I think, you know, it goes back even further than that, from leaving the world of restaurants and coming into Whole Foods was never an intentional thing. It happened, you know, quite accidentally. After 9/11, where I was working in a brand new restaurant in New Orleans, it didn't make it. And so I went on a journey of trying to find, you know, another position. I even cooked at an art facility in the Hamptons for a while, in an outside cabin, basically, with no equipment and just grills. And then ended up in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I got a line cook position at the El Dorado Hotel at the Old House Restaurant, and, you know, obviously wasn't making any money. So I started working for Whole Foods early in the morning in the seafood department, like 5 a.m., and I did both jobs for a while. And I really liked Whole Foods. I liked the philosophy. I liked the core values. I liked the company. And, you know, I worked two jobs for a while, and I just couldn't do it anymore. So I made the decision, like, you know, what the hell? I'm gonna work for a grocery store. And in doing so and getting to, you know, the regional executive chef for Rocky Mountain position, like I said, when I started working with the spices and I was able to, like, really focus on them and discover this whole new world that I had never, I dabbled in it, stuck my toe in it, but, you know, most of us don't have the time to dig deep. There's so many other responsibilities. And the more I dug and the more I played around with them and the more I learned, the more excited and passionate I got. So when they posted that position, it was a no-brainer for me at the time. I was like, I want to commit, you know, I'm ready to commit. I'm ready to take another plunge, you know, out of what I think, you know, being a chef means, and, you know, move into more of a research chef type of role. So it was a no-brainer at the time. You know, I was emotionally invested.
And you've also, I want to make sure we get to talk about this aspect of your career, because you've not only worked in spices at Whole Foods, but also taken on several leadership positions with the American Spice Trade Association. So talk a little bit about that, what the organization does and how you've been involved.
Sure. That's a great topic. We joined AFSTA, American Spice Trade Association, shortly after we started the program. So it's probably 2011. And I went to the annual conference for the first time. And I looked around and I was surrounded by people who were passionate about spices. I was like, I felt like I had come home, you know, and went through that conference and just really connected. And they were looking for volunteers for a new committee, which was called the Education Committee. And, you know, I talked to the executive director. I was like, look, here's my skill set. Here's what I can bring to the table. You have several committees that, you know, that are new to the organization. I was like, put me wherever you think, you know, I'll be the best benefit to the association. And she's like, I think you definitely need to be on the education committee. And did that for a couple of years. And one day I got this random call from the executive director chit-chatting. And then she says, hey, look, I want to ask you a question. How would you like to be on the board of directors? And I was like, another one of those weird moments, like when I got offered the executive chef job with 7 months experience, I was like, what? Me on a board of directors? Like that's like for other people, right? And talked to my boss, he approved it and started a 6-year journey. It's typically, they ask you to volunteer for 3 years on the board. I was in my second year and the director who was going to move into the treasurer position had to resign from the board. And so she called me again and she's like, we'd like to move you into the executive committee, which basically means you'll be the treasurer, you'll be the VP, and then you'll be the president and then the immediate past president. And I was like, again, like, what? Did you call the right person? Like, why me? So, you know, all of that is obviously incredibly flattering. But the association and working on the board does so many great things for the industry. And I think there are some spice companies in the U.S. that, you know, I don't understand why they don't belong, because if you're producing spices, manufacturing spices, selling spices, importing spices in the U.S., why would you not want to belong to the organization that speaks up for you and the industry, you know, within the parameters of regulations and government? I was amazed at how much work we do in collaboration with the FDA to try to get regulations in place that make sense for spices, that benefit us in any way possible, that are not, you know, negative in any way towards our organization or make it harder for people in the industry to get their job done, basically. We did a lot of work with EPA. It's just so fascinating, and I just absolutely loved it. And working with, you know, a team of people from all types of genre of spices, from presidents of companies to sales directors to marketing people to people in food safety, people on their regulatory teams, and coming together and just trying to work for the benefit of our industry so hard all the time. And it was an absolutely wonderful experience. I came off as immediate past president this April. Unfortunately, we didn't have our conference this year because of COVID, but absolutely wonderful experience. So now I'm continuing on with the organization. I'm on the annual conference program committee this year, and also I continue to be on the Organic Task Force committee.
That's great. And yeah, I mean, I attended my first meeting as you were stepping down from the presidency. So I only got to catch the very tail end of it, but looking forward to what you do with the organization going forward. In the last few minutes of the interview, we like to do a more fun rapid fire question segment. So I'm going to throw some fun questions at you and then we'll wrap up. Sound good?
Sounds good. Don't have high expectations. I'm a little bit slow.
I'm old. All right. We'll try it out. It'll be fun either way.
Okay.
What's your most important kitchen tool? What do you reach for most often when you're cooking?
Obviously, my favorite knife. Beyond that, I like my little handheld microplane for small, mighty jobs.
Good. I don't think anybody's answered. I don't think anybody's said microplane before. That's great. Mm-hmm.
It's great for like grating garlic into a vinaigrette. Super fun.
Yeah, for sure. If you were a summer vegetable, what vegetable would you be?
A tomato. Definitely not technically a vegetable, but
close enough.
Nothing like a sun-warmed vegetable tomato straight out of the garden, just with a sprinkle of salt. Nothing better.
The best. What did you eat for lunch growing up as a kid?
Now you're stumping me.
Or breakfast? Well, what was like a day-to-day meal at home in your family?
I would have to say the thing we ate a lot of was the rice and gravy. I'd have to go with rice and gravy.
All right. You've traveled a lot. What's a meal that really stands out for you from one of your international trips?
Oh, wow. My God, there's so many. I'm looking at a map right now in my office. I have a world map. I was in the Republic of Georgia, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I had rented a car for the day, and I was touring some of the wineries in that region, in the Kakheti region, and I stopped at a winery, I did a tour, and they had a restaurant on the premises, outside actually, and they had like a tandoor oven outside and a grill, and I don't know if you're familiar with the Georgian cheese bread, chachapuri, where it's like a boat stuffed with cheese and egg, which is just amazing. But in this region, the version that they made, they would take chunks of the sulguni cheese and put it on a skewer, and then take a yeast dough that was rolled out in strips and wrapped it around, if you can imagine, and then they grilled it.
So it was sort of a grilled, breaded cheese stuffed bread.
Wow. Yeah, like a grilled bread wrapped cheese, molten cheese skewer.
Amazing.
Over like a, you know, like wood fire with branches, local branches of trees, and some of the wine that they produced, and sitting out in that garden, heaven, absolute heaven.
Yeah, with a good glass of wine, sounds perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Simone, thank you. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show this week. Where can our listeners, if they wanted to taste the fruits of your labor, taste one of the blends that you've created, where would they do that?
Probably the easiest place would be in Whole Foods Market. A lot of the stores carry a little clear zip top pouch with the Whole Foods Market organic cooking brand on it. So we have a lot of spices and seasoning blends there. And I'd also ask people if they want to check out our website. Our new brand is called Vox, V-O-X Spice. And you can go to voxspice.com. We have a newsletter there. It's a spice journal that I wrote for team members at Whole Foods, kind of a different spice, each spice journal. So you can sign up to get those. And we are working on an e-commerce platform right now that we hope to have up and running in hopefully November. And there will be a selection of 23 of my favorite blends on there for purchase. So it'll be a great place to go.
Sounds delicious. And as always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can follow us on social media, YFood Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. You can follow me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, @BurlapandBarrel on Instagram. And you can follow Valerie on Instagram @FoodieInNewYork. Thanks to Jess Kranjic, our sound engineer, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. And most of all, Simone, thank you so much for joining. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Ethan, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a great pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks. See you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.